Produced by Wayne Hall, Bill Govier, Preston Frazier, and Jeffrey Cresselius. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 429. Sid Smith, Doyen of the Sleeve Note.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 429 of the Yes Music Podcast. Two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later. You can always get involved with the podcast, and please do, via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week we blew away the lockdown cobwebs by means of a bracing conversation with the ever-jovial and generous Sid Smith. Responsible for many Yes, King Crimson and other Sleeve Notes, he shared his approaches and a story or two. It was a very enjoyable chat. Before that, though, I only have time for a brief set of updates this week. Over on the YMP Facebook page, Keith Hoisington spotted a rare glimpse of Steve Howe talking on his Facebook page about his new book, All My Yesterdays. He seems very pleased with it indeed. Simon Barrow has produced a great review of the memoir, and we will, of course, do a feature on it as soon as I've finished reading it myself. Preston Frazier and many others enjoyed last week's episode on Sleeve Notes and selected his own favourites, as did the commenters on last week's show notes: John Handley, John Thompson, Ken Fuller, John Parry, Dave Watkinson and Miguel Falcao. We all, I'm sure, joined Mark in saying happy birthday to Benoit David, one of the stars of the most recent Yes release, From a Page. And Daniel Crone added a highly amusing review of Yes, or ARW, live at the Apollo. Daniel also appeared live on Facebook with some great guitar renditions of Yes songs, and I hope he does that again. Roger Dean, thanks it seems to the camera work of his daughter Freya, has taken to broadcasting live on Facebook. Every other day he is sharing his progress on the painting for what he revealed is the new Yes album. It was the first I'd heard of the idea. Don't get overexcited though, because it's The Royal Affair Live, not the new studio album. However, the live videos have already been a captivating view of Dean's process, and I can't wait to see more. Preston has reached In the Presence of From Magnification in his review series, and Keith Hoisington was first to bring my attention to the major interview with Steve Howe, which is on loudersound.com. In the visitor posts, Jeffrey Mason's Hall this week included Roger Dean at home in those videos, Alan White sharing a comic PSA from the Newcastle Police about social distancing, Rick Wakeman's latest charity push, this time for Life Limited Children, that Steve Howe interview, and an article from Billboard magazine on Yes on the Radio from a long time ago. H.B. Pedersen also added a review of the Steve Howe book, which is well worth a read, and over on Twitter there were the usual myriad of interesting posts, but I should mention Stampy's photo of a certain pile of rocks in the deep southwest of England. As always, thank you very much indeed to everyone who's been in touch this week.
Welcome to the Yes Music Podcast with Kevin Mulrine and Mark Anthony Kay.
It's fantastic to welcome Sid Smith back onto the podcast this week. And I do say back because the last time you were here, Sid, it was October 2013. A bit's happened in that time.
Blimey, was it that long ago?
Yes, it was. I just looked it up.
Good grief. Time flies when you're having fun, Kevin.
It does. And Mark is here as well. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. Hello there, Sid.
Hi, Mark.
So if you don't know Sid Smith, you definitely should. He's one of the great gentlemen of progressive rock, and he does his own podcast, and he writes in Prog Magazine, a recent Roger Dean feature written by Sid. And if you have the Stephen Wilson remixes on CD of the five Yes albums, then the Sleeve Notes are by him, and that's why we wanted to talk to him today. So, Sid, you've got an extensive collection of recordings of all types, I understand. So what do you look for in liner or sleeve notes in the albums that you collect?
Well, when I was a little kid, and I mean, you know, kind of you know, five-ish, that kind of age. Mm. My parents played kind of essentially classical music, you know, popular classical music, nothing too heavy, and Rodgers and Hammerstein kind of soundtracks. Mm. And one of the points, and of course my sisters were into, you know, pop music like the Beatles and what have you. So I could read as a child before I ever went to school, thanks to my mother. And one of the things that I used to spend a lot of time doing with my mother would be listening to these records and reading the sleeve notes, because most of the records back then, even contemporary records like with the Beatles and what have you, they often had sleeve notes. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't really understand, you know, what the sleeve notes were saying about Mozart's Eine kleine Nacht music, but the point was, you know, I was new to reading and I was keen just to read, and there was always that sort of nice little circuit where you read something aloud and your parents pat you on the head and say, well done, you know. So it was there was a kind of a good reason to do it. Now that might sound slightly flippant, but from an early age for me, music and narrative, an external narrative in the shape of sleeve notes, was kind of hardwired into me from a very early age. So it's always something I've, you know, been interested in. And I would always, when I would buy an album, you know, I would always see if there was like liner notes, you know, sleeve notes. Yeah. And it was that kind of, you know, you had the music and that's great. And really, honestly, the music's all you need. You don't need somebody to essentially guide you through the process. But nevertheless, it's sometimes quite helpful and quite handy to have somebody to do that. So for me, what I always look for when I buy something, particularly if it's a historical thing, you know, I have been known to buy things simply on the strength of sleeve notes, you know, because... and in this day and age, where pretty much everything's streaming these days, etc., you don't get the sleeve notes. You don't get that context. And sometimes, like with a Frank Sinatra album, something like that, the contemporary sleeve notes that were written in 1950, whenever, can be very, very content rich. You know, can really in and of their own. You know, they can stand alone almost. So for me, it's always about what's the story? What is this album about? Where did it come from? What was the artist doing? And if you think about, say, the liner notes to an album like With the Beatles, you know, the liner notes there are kind of, you know, very kind of popsy, salesy kind of, hey, it's a hip happening kind of thing, you know. And also there is also kind of an expectation that the sleeve notes, they could be writing about any beat group of the day. Mm. Ironically, of course, you know, a band like the Beatles kind of begat a whole literary industry, which, I mean, if you laid every Beatles book from end to end, it would stretch from here to, you know, God knows where. You know, so for me, the sleeve notes, the narrative that complement the music, you know, was always something I was interested in, and it's always something I do look for. And as I said at the start, though, do you need the sleeve notes to get the music, to understand the music? Probably not. But isn't it nice to have something that provides you with or illustrates, you know, the kind of the context and where this music came from?
Yeah, absolutely. So then that gets to my question then, which is, how did you get started writing liner notes for bands?
I'm trying to think that the first... I mean, I've written a couple of hundred, maybe more, sort of liner notes over the years, and just off the top of my head, I can't remember the first one that I did commercially. But the short answer to your question, Mark, is somebody asked me to write the liner notes for something, and so I just thought, yeah, all right, I'll do that, and it, you know. It, it's nice. It's always nice to be asked to be involved in a project with a band that you like. You know.
Well, then I guess then the follow up to that would be: was it based on something that you had done prior to it? Like, did you write an article and some band saw it and said, "Okay, I want to have this chap write the liner notes"?
It tends to work in probably two ways in terms of being commissioned, or at least my experience of being commissioned to write liner notes. One is sometimes a band will come and get you, will come and knock on the door of social media or wherever, and they'll say, "We've got an album coming out. Can you write us some sleeve notes?" And that would be, like a contemporary band, rather than an archive project, which tends to come from a different source. So I do those. I do some of those. I don't always do everything that I get offered, because sometimes when I hear the music, I realize I'm not the right fit for it. I'm not the person who would give that particular band the right kind of presentation. But sometimes I absolutely am the right person, and I'll go into it with gusto. With archive material, and it tends to be archive material, so just off the top of my head, I'm thinking of something like, I wrote some years ago, EMI were putting a Talk compilation. There's endless Talk compilations, but like years ago I'm talking about. And I'd done one job for Virgin Records at the time, and somebody in Virgin Records just needed somebody to write some sleeve notes for a Talk compilation. And one of the people who worked at Virgin sort of said, "Oh, I've just used this bloke here. He'll do it." So that, that would be a typical way you'd get those kinds of jobs. And then, kind of one job sometimes leads to another. Not in every case, but often it does. And the archive material can also come from, I did some liner notes for an album by Paul Jones, who used to be in Manfred Mann. And he recorded an album on the Vertigo label called Crucifix in a Horseshoe. And there was a reissue company called, RPM. And they'd kind of just read something on the net that I'd written, because I used to do a blog. So that's how they came to get in touch. Mm-hmm. And, there was a whole unreleased side of two sides of an unreleased album that Paul recorded for Vertigo, but never got released. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew who the musicians were, etc. But they sent me the tapes, and I thought I was able to identify who the players were, because Paul Jones was a huge jazz fan, and he was using, like London jazzers. So my point is, sometimes record companies kind of get you to come to you for one thing, but then you end up doing something else,
Yeah. So Sid, you did the liner notes for these five Yes Stephen Wilson remixes, as I've already said. So the Yes album to Relayer, which I've got in front of me here. But with the benefit of a few years now since those came out, what's your feeling about this kind of reimagining of iconic albums, remixing them and so on?
I think the first thing I would say about these remix projects is the original stereo mix is the kind of it's the lodestar. It's the original imprint. And in that sense, can you mix it better than Eddie offered? Now, it's possible you can, of course, new technology, different sets of ears, et cetera, et cetera. But let's face it, when you've got somebody like Eddie Offord or Ian Other engineer, the original recordings are pretty good. So it's important to understand what a remix project isn't. The remix project and the 5.1 remixes that Stephen Wilson undertook wasn't about saying, "Well, these Eddie Offord mixes are quite poor, so we're going to give you something that's much better." That's absolutely, resolutely not what would be in Stephen Wilson's mind, nor in the people who commissioned Stephen Wilson to remix them. What the remix project, I think, is and works best at is it takes the sonic information of the stereo mix, the original stereo mix, which is 9 times out of 10, it's always the best. Mm. And it says, here's this information, because usually this doesn't happen with every reissue, but with the panegyric reissues, panegyric are very good at presenting the original stereo mixes. So you've always got those as your baseline. Yeah. But then on top of that are all these alternative mixes, these panoramic, quite literally, sonic panoramas of the 5.1 mix, which are designed to often make quite subtle but sometimes quite different mixing choices. So one of the criticisms of these mixes is, the Mellotron doesn't sound right. Mm. Well, the Mellotron, it's not that the Mellotron doesn't sound right per se, although that might be the case in one or two instances perhaps, but it's not that it doesn't sound right, it's that it's different. And of course, we're so, if you've been listening to, I don't know, Relay for however many years it is since that came out, then, that music is pretty fixed in your psyche, So then to hear a different sound of it can be pretty jarring and not always a pleasurable experience for people. I mean, I think that's fair to say. Not everybody, likes the way what these remixes do. Mm-hmm. That said, I think often if you've got, I sometimes find myself just absolutely thrilled. We mentioned Relay.
Yeah.
I can't remember the names of the tracks. Second track, say two. Is it To Be Over?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. This is just down to me personally. Everybody else would have different experiences. I always liked Relay. I always thought it was a decent enough album. Mm. But I always thought the third track on side two, it never connected with me, for whatever reason, the way sometimes things do,
Yeah.
And then we were working on the remixes. And so one of the early mixes duly arrived and I stuck it on. And I sort of sat there and I was gobsmacked at what this remix had brought out. So I went immediately to the original album and it's kind of there, but I just missed it. It's kind of sitting underneath a whole load of other things that grabbed my attention 40 years ago. Yeah. And I've never been able to, push that information aside to be able to hear all this under detail.
Yeah.
Whereas the remix did that loud and clear for me, because of the spatial separation that you get with 5.1. Mm-hmm. And I listened to it with fresh ears and I thought, this could well be the best track that Yes have ever done. So I went from being indifferent to the track.
Yeah.
To kind of, being a born again zealot about it, now that doesn't happen with every remix, but it happens more often than you might think. I mean, that could just well be a testimony to my poor listening skills, as a younger man, but I think there is something wrapped up in the spatial experience and being surrounded, literally and figuratively, by this information coming at you out of speakers. And it can be a very moving experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, just thinking about your actual essays, your notes in these packages for Yes, they were fascinating, I thought. And I think you succeed really well in telling the story of the album's creation, informed by new interviews, which I know you did with the band members, as well as putting that music into its historical context. And I'm imagining that's what you were going for, was it?
Yeah, I always sort of feel that the job isn't to tell you what I think.
Right, yeah.
I don't feel. I mean, some writers do that, and they're very good at that. I'm not so fussed on that. It's fine if you want to do that. I'm not criticising anyone who does. But for me, The job is I come to it. We keep talking about Relay, but it could be any of the Yes albums. But like with Relay, what I was interested in, like with all the Yes albums, I wanted to know what the band thought as much as possible, where, you know, through fresh interviews where I could get them. And I wanted to be able to explain relatively succinctly, you know, how this music came about, and then what happened after the music came out, I suppose, and the impact it had. Now, with Yes fans, or indeed King Crimson fans, or, you know, whoever, but Yes fans in particular, I would say, are fairly knowledgeable people. They're heavily invested. The chances are they've already bought this music 62 times on a previous occasions on all sorts of formats. Yeah. And I'm one of those people. I put my hand up to that and say, you know, not necessarily with Yes, but with other bands, you know, I'm the same, you know.
Yeah.
The balance is somebody like yourself, Kevin and Mark, who know the far, you know more about Yes than I'll know. So I'm not really writing these liner notes aimed at someone like yourself. I'm writing them at somebody who is more of a casual fan, and because there's an advertising splurge connected to the reissue of the album, they might just pick them up. One thing I have learned is, particularly through my work with King Crimson, is we make an assumption that every fan is on the same page and that every fan knows everything. Now, that's not true. So sometimes what the sleeve notes achieve is they will set out a very basic story with some fundamental building blocks that everybody knows, but you try and do it in an entertaining way and an informative way. You hope that the more experienced seasoned fans, you know, will kind of be forgiving when it comes to it. And, you know, so far, touch wood, you know, people have been reasonably generous about it, like from the hardcore fans that have been in touch with me about it.
Yeah.
They sometimes say some nice things. I guess there might be people out there who have nasty things to say, but have held back, and I salute their restraint.
Indeed. Yeah. So, what I'm very curious about, Sid, is what was it like speaking to the Yes band members as you researched the sleeve notes for these releases? Was anyone particularly surprising to you?
I interview musicians for a living. That's what I do. I don't have any other means of income. I'm a full-time freelance writer, writing about music and musicians. And what happens 9 times out of 10, whether they're a member of Yes or whether they're, you know, in some other band, particularly with archive work, you've got to remember what you're ringing them up to say is, can you tell me what you were doing on a wet Wednesday afternoon 47 years ago? And, you know, that's a huge ask. I'm in my 60s, and I can't tell you what I was doing 47 years ago. And of course, the other thing we expect these musicians to know, often for these musicians, not necessarily just with Yes, but often, you know, it was a couple of weeks' work, and it was a small part of a 40, 50-year career. And then the other factor that you have to, as a writer, that you have to navigate is band politics.
Yeah.
And band politics, in the case of Yes, is you don't need me to tell you or your listeners, is you know, quite tricky. The brim thing. I mean, it's extensive, you know. And that's just kind of, you know, with easy underarm questions like, so tell me, Chris, what do you remember about recording the bass line to Heart of the Sunrise? You know, that could, you know, maybe that's not quite that question, but it's something like that. And, you know, so Chris Squire has been playing this bass line for God knows how many years. Is he really going to be able to remember what it was like playing that bass line? Well, of course not. But he also, you know, he's been asked that question a zillion times before. But what I would say is most of them kind of always respond with good grace. They pretend, for the most part, they pretend that this is the first time that anyone's ever asked them that question, you know, which is very good of them to do that. Yeah. Bearing in mind that these reissues were, you know, reissues that the band and their management, the band, whoever the band is, and their management had agreed and sanctioned. So that doesn't always mean that it's going to be an easy interview. And not every musician wants to do it. You know, Mark asked me, was I surprised by anything that I heard? I'm not so much surprised, but sometimes it's amazing what people remember. And you get, so you think they're going to remember one thing, and then, you know, they just don't. It's like not a thing for them. But then sometimes you'd get, I can remember talking to Steve Howe about one of the recordings, and Steve went into the nth degree. I was amazed by what he remembered. The problem is, so Steve Howe was amazingly generous with his time on a couple of these jobs. But here's the problem. What Steve's telling you, whilst it's interesting and whilst it's informative from the perspective of the guitar and the role of the guitar and his thoughts about how the guitar operates within that music, you could fill a 42-page booklet with what he's telling you.
Yes.
but of course, that's not going to be a good read. You're trying as a writer to bring all the voices of all the experiences as best you can, because sometimes people are being diplomatic about what they don't say. And you're trying to present it in a kind of a more rounded way. So you as interesting as Steve Howe's comments may be about the guitar, you have to edit it. You have to kind of say, you know, maybe if this was a guitarist magazine that I'm writing an article for, it would be perfect, perhaps. But even then, it's probably way too much detail. You have to balance those experiences. Yeah. Inevitably, the thing that you think it might be important isn't always the thing that they think is important.
Absolutely. So I've been reading your book, In the Court of King Crimson, which I'm absolutely loving, Sid. So you tell the story of the band in a really engaging way, and it's also opened my eyes to a sort of different slant on the music scene at the time. Both Yes and King Crimson were making waves in London and so on. And I'd recommend it to any Yes fan, particularly with the obvious Bruford, Anderson and other connections with King Crimson. But tell us about your book and how it's recently been updated.
I always wanted to read a book about King Crimson back in the 80s and 90s. I'd sort of lost touch with King Crimson in the 80s. And one thing and another, at some point in the late 80s, I thought it'd be great if somebody wrote a book. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there wasn't too many kind of rock biographies. I mean, there were a few, but it wasn't quite the industry that it is today, let's say. Mm-hmm. So at some point, I think it must have been in the 90s, Faber and Faber published Eric Tam's book on Robert Fripp and King Crimson. And I thought, well, that's it. Great. Job done. You know, I'm very pleased that somebody's done that. And I bought it. And I loved it. But I found myself at the end of it with lots more, if you like, more questions asked than perhaps were answered. Very quickly, in 2001, I published my biography of King Crimson, which did very well commercially at the time. You know, it's been referenced by numerous academic tomes and studies and so on and so forth. But obviously, with a band like King Crimson and the longevity of a band like King Crimson, the original book, as I say, was published in 2001, and it caught them. it left the band as they were about to undertake an American tour in 2001. So over the years, I've had numerous requests to update the book. And for a whole variety of reasons, I always resisted wanting to do an update of the book. However, what persuaded me was in 2019, you know, it was the 50th anniversary of the band. And it just seemed like, yep, that's the right, that felt like something to hang it on. Because with a band that's as, that runs as long as King Crimson has, kind of, it's out of date the minute it goes to press. And funnily enough, I'd finished the book, and in April in 2019, I went down to a press conference that in London that Robert Fripp was doing, and about the 50th anniversary of King Crimson. And during Robert's 7-hour press conference, I was there with the publisher and one or two other people, and we went over the road in a break to the pub to have something to eat. And I said to the publisher, I said, well, he's never said that before in public. I've heard him say it in private, but he's never said it in public before. And the publisher said, you're going to need to revise the book. So just when I thought I'd finished it, you know, I immediately then had to start revising. And that happened 2 or 3 times, actually. And of course, the books, you know, we did eventually get it published in 2019. And it's done very well. And I'm very pleased that, you know, people, the reviews of it have been very generous. And I think what it does is it provides a snapshot. What it isn't, it's not a history of progressive music.
No.
It's not, it doesn't attempt to compare and contrast. I mean, other bands do come into the narrative, but not in that way. And it's not a biography of Robert Fripp. Robert Fripp is a central character in the book, but he's not the only character in the book. And what I've tried to do in the book is to ensure that there are plenty of other perspectives, not just Robert Fripp's perspective. Although, you know, Robert was incredibly helpful and incredibly generous with his time during the writing of the book, but so were many other members of King Crimson. And so I wanted to, you know, make sure I honored that spirit, if you like.
So being a huge fan of King Crimson, I own pretty much everything that they've ever released, including the 40th anniversary releases that came out. And they have some absolutely fantastic sleeve notes that you've written for them. Do you have any favorites amongst those 40th anniversary releases?
Well, the short answer is no, because I hate them. I think, like a lot of people, like, well, when I say I hate them, all I mean by that is, I mean, hands up, everyone who likes hearing the sound of their own voice when it's been recorded. Yeah. Most people don't like hearing their own voice when it's recorded.
Mm. I've gotten used to it.
So I don't like reading those liner notes, because for me, what I see when I read, if I read back notes that I've done, and this would apply to the notes with Yes, is, you know, I see places where I ran out of time. And, you know, I had to make a compromise, or I had to cut something out because it was over long. And I couldn't think of an elegant solution, a literary solution. So, you know, sometimes you just cut and the text feels very abrupt and kind of, you know, awkward. So for me, a lot of those sleeve notes come under that category, because sometimes they're done in short order. But by and large, I would stand by them, because they purport and I think do tell the story of those individual albums. Just sometimes not as, how can I put it, not as elegantly as I would like. It's worth noting the word count for the Yes reissues per booklet is around 2,000 words. The word count for the King Crimson 40th anniversary sleeve notes is about 1,000 words. So you know, if you ask me which set of jobs do I prefer, I prefer the Yes ones, because generally there was more room in which to convey the story and do it justice. Sometimes with the King Crimson ones, they just look very rushed and they feel a bit pinched for me. But yeah. but broadly speaking, they do the job, I think.
Great. So I also own quite a few of the box sets, and where you have quite extensive sleeve notes. Personally, I enjoyed the Road to Red and the Starless box sets. How do you approach writing notes for those box sets, since they are closely connected to the albums that you've already written liner notes for, like the 40th anniversary records?
It's two different things. The 40th anniversary booklets, you know, they're a snapshot of sometimes 1 year or 3 years, you know. With those extended essays in the big boxes that you're talking about, that's a different job altogether. You know, those essays can be 15,000 words, 20,000 words. You know, it's a completely different thing in terms of the scope and what you're trying to achieve. And the approach there is to say, let's look at this period in depth. So with the Road to Red, you know, you're not talking about an album, although you are. You know, you are talking about the making of Red, but you're actually going into depth and detail about the process of what led these still then young men. What happened to those young men when they were out on the road in America? What happens to a person when you're traversing a country that's as big as America and can be radically different from place to place? What happens to a person when they are packed into a tiny van or even a large van and driven, you know, ridiculous amounts of miles? How do individuals cope with that? What happens to the psyche? Not everybody copes with it in the same way. Well, they definitely don't cope with it in the same way. Yeah. And I had on the Road to Red thing, there was quite an amusing incident. You know, I'd interviewed Bill Bruford, I'd interviewed John Wetton, I'd interviewed Robert Fripp and David Cross. But just for the Bill Bruford told me, he said, well, so I said to Bill, I said, how do you stay sane? What do you do? You know? And when you're on the road, and he said, well, you know, he says, I read a lot, and he says, but what kept me going was I was teaching myself to play alto sax. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And I said, when were you doing that? He said, well, you know, I'd get to a, you know, we'd do a gig, I'd get to the hotel room, I'd get the saxophone out. He says, I'd stuff a pair of socks down the bell, you know, so it wasn't like loud, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe open the cupboard, you know, the cupboard door and play into that, you know, and it gave me a focus, you know. And I said, all right, okay. And then, you know, so that was good. I'd not heard that. I'd not read that anywhere before. So then I had business talking with John Wetton, and I mentioned it to John, and he said, oh, he's pulling your leg, man. You know, there's no way he was doing that. And I said, really? Because I said, he sounded pretty sincere. He says, nah, he says, there's no way he was learning to play saxophone. So after that conversation, I rang Bill back, and I said, Bill, I just want to check on this saxophone thing, because it's like, you know, I don't want to go to press. If you're just having a bit of fun with me, you know, fair enough, you know. And he said, what would John Wetton know what I was doing in my hotel room? He says, he was always in there with a woman or two, you know, kind of partying away. He wouldn't have a clue what I was doing in my hotel room, you know. And Bill was adamant that the alto sax story was true, and indeed it was, you know. So the point about that is, you've got two very different approaches to how you live your life on the road. One is quite insular, quite focused on music, and quite, I mean, you know, Bill isn't a monk, and, you know, but the difference was, Bill was married, you know, he was quite a serious. He was looking to learn something about harmony, etc., etc. So that's how Bill was using his time. John, who was a single man, blessed with good looks and charm and all the rest of it, and you know, John fulfilled what he wanted to do, which was something quite different. Mm-hmm. So in talking to them about that approach, you've got in those large essays. You see, I wouldn't put that into a small 1,000 word liner note, but I would put that kind of information, and indeed did, into a much more extended essay.
Yeah. So, is there anything else in the pipeline for you at the moment? Are you working on any other sleeve notes at the moment?
So, things I'm working on at the moment. I've been commissioned to do another book, and what that's doing in relation to sleeve notes is what happens when you write liner notes. Sometimes is you're writing liner notes for a very particular edition. Now, if we look at the Yes catalogue, I think Kevin or Mark will know the precise number here, but I think the Yes catalogue, since it appeared on Panegyric, has been sold on and repackaged. Is it twice or is it just once? I'm not sure. The point of that story the point with that story is my liner notes don't travel with that, if you see what I mean. My liner notes were commissioned by a company, in this instance Panegyric. So the book I'm doing at the moment is, so bearing in mind I've written, as I say, a couple of hundred liner notes for numerous different bands over the years and different companies. So I'm doing a kind of a book at the moment, currently untitled, which gathers together a lot of these liner notes, which are out of print, which you can't get them anymore, or you can't easily get them. And also that gives me the opportunity to sometimes rewrite passages, which, you know, for a whole variety of reasons, don't work or didn't work at the time, but you ran out of time, so you just had to press send, and there it was. It's in print, and you're not happy with it, but there's nothing you can do about it. Mm. Except with this project, I can revisit them. And sometimes you don't have the space to let the artist speak fully. So with this project, which will basically be confined to the late 60s to the late 70s. So it's roughly a 10-year period. And a lot of the bands, I think I will be putting the Yes sleeve notes into that book, but also I've written various other things on Yes over the years, and I'll be looking for a way to probably include that extra information, if you see what I mean. But it's not just Yes, there'll be other. I don't think I need to put any Crimson in there, because I've kind of done that with the Crimson book.
Yes.
But there'll be hopefully a kind of a sideways view at the 70s world of, not strictly speaking, it's not always prog rock, progressive rock, but it kind of, you know, comes under that broad heading.
Umbrella?
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, I do look forward to that. That sounds absolutely brilliant.
And yes.
Sid, thank you very much indeed for your time. I think I did say all those years ago that we'd have you back on the show. It's taken us quite a long time, but hopefully when you have something like that fascinating sounding book out, you'll come back and speak to us again.
Yeah, I'd love to. I just before we go, one of the things I loved working on, by the way, was the reissue of Chris Squire's Fish Out of Water,
which
is just a that was such a joy to work on, because the music was, the original, we were talking about original recordings, you know.
Yeah.
That original recording is just so good. Yeah. It remains one of my favourite albums, you know, Head and Shoulders in some cases above other bands. And it's certainly the best album that Yes never recorded, as far as I'm concerned. So it was a joy to work on that. So if you're ever doing something on Fish Out of Water, count me in.
Absolutely. Okay, that sounds like a plan. All right, so thank you very much indeed, Sid and Mark.
You're welcome.
Cheers.
Yes.
Just before we go, here are the patrons and the producers. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Griselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And half of the patrons are Aaron Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, Lind, Dave Pannell, Dave Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Guy Jerome, Henrik Antonsen, H.B. Pettersen, Ian N.B., Jamie McQuinn, Ken Fuller, Michael Handahan, Jim, John Cowan, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, and Barry Gorski. Continued thanks to Robert and David. If you'd like to join these patrons in helping to keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, then please do go to patreon.com, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details, or just click on the Patreon button on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening once again. We'll be back next week, I do hope. But in the meantime, please do get involved on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Instagram. Just search for Yes Music Podcast. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.